So the talk tonight, I'm calling it 7 years in China. And so for those of you who don't have a program, I'm just going to read it. A very brief, partly true history of Soto Zen. So I'll read what's on the program and then tell you how this came about. The program says, Zen teacher and author David Loy wrote a book called The World is Made of Stories. The story that shaped our Soto Zen practice and training methods is an epic one, with all the elements of a good drama. Heroes, underdogs, revolutions, persecutions, and songs. Sounds pretty exciting, doesn't it? So how this came about, my talking about the history of Soto Zen, is three things happened, kind of converged. And that is, I'm teaching a class called Original Zen, and I'm talking about our early Chinese ancestors in this class, and also the Soto Zen Convention was held here this past weekend for 3 days, Wednesday through Sunday, however many days that is. I was only there for 3 days. First time ever in the Midwest, so that was kind of a big event for us. And the keynote speaker at that event was David Loy, who wrote many books, one of which, my favorite of which, is The World is Made of Stories. So this seemed pretty appropriate to talk about the history of Soto Zen. You know, how this is a Soto Zen school. So I thought I would just talk about how we got here. And the subtitle is A Very Brief, Partly True History of Zen. And that's because our history is mythological. And Zen, we are not so concerned about historical facts as much as we're concerned about relating the Dharma. And so in mythology, you know, we're more concerned with pointing to the deeper truth than, you know, historical facts. And the lineage that I'm going to be talking about tonight goes all the way back to the Buddha. And it's a very concrete way of saying that this practice that we do has been practiced continuously for 2,500 years. And this long list of ancestors that we talk about is saying to us, you can trust this. It's been around for 2,500 years. It's been deepened and clarified and practiced and trusted for 2,500 years. So don't waste your time questioning it or doubting it or defending it. Just give yourself to it. Just trust this practice. So that's what our mythology is all about. That's what our lineage is all about. I want to credit the teachings of Zen teacher Taigen Lighten for some of the things I'll be covering tonight. And also I want to credit this book, Making Zen Your Own, by Janet Abels, which is the text that we use in the class that I'm teaching, Original Zen. So I'm going to go through these 700 years. Very quickly, highlighting certain centuries of the 700 years, and also certain Zen teachers, and particularly focusing on two things: the turning points of the methods of training, and the deepening and clarifying of the teaching, of the teachings with each of these centuries that I'm going to be going down. So a lot of this stuff is not, if you're new, then a lot of this stuff is not going to be very familiar to you. But I think that you'll get the gist of it. And the gist of it is, we tend to, often we kind of put our, the icons of Zen, they're up so high on a pedestal that, you know, we feel teeny weeny in comparison. But, you know, what you'll see tonight, hopefully, is that each of these teachers stood on the shoulders of the teachers that came before them. And that is exactly what those of us who are practicing today is also called to do. So we can't feel like little tiny peons in comparison to our ancestors, but because the calling is too great, you know, we have to continue deepening and clarifying, and perhaps even devising new techniques of training. So that's my purpose for this talk tonight, and I'm going to start in the 6th century with Bodhidharma. Bodhidharma was a South Indian prince who was the 28th ancestor, Indian ancestor, back to the Buddha. And he is also the first Zen ancestor. He took the teachings of Zen to China. He is credited with taking the teachings of Zen to China. Buddhism, this was the 6th century, Buddhism had been in China for centuries before this. Supposedly, the method of training and the understanding of Buddhism before Bodhidharma in relation to Zen Buddhism in particularly, their understanding was kind of superficial, very academic, because they relied on and studied heavily and recited the sutras. And when Bodhidharma came to China, he brought new insights into the teachings of Buddha. And I just want to talk about few of the central themes of his life. One, the rejection of all forms of dogmatism, which was new because they were very dogmatic about their sutras and what the sutras said. The second was the cultivation of non-attachment, which also means non-attachment to Buddhism, the teachings, non-attachment to the sutras, the scriptures. And he also brought the idea of Buddha nature, that we all share the mind of Buddha. And he promoted the idea of emptiness of both persons and things, all dharmas. And he also taught that enlightenment is available to anyone who can see their own true nature, who can experience their own enlightened Buddha mind. So that was kind of new stuff for, as far as we know. I'll keep, you know, reminding myself and everybody else. This is our mythology. And so the method of training that he brought and he promoted was, first of all, meditation. So they weren't doing that much meditation in China before that. They were studying the sutras, reciting the sutras, chanting the sutras, memorizing the sutras. Not a lot of looking into themselves, and that's what meditation is all about. Eventually, once we slow our mind down a little bit, we start to tap into our own intuitive knowledge. And the second method of training that Bodhidharma promoted was the passing down of the teachings directly from teacher to student. So he taught that the training was in the context of relationship, as opposed to individual endeavors are relying on the sutras. So here's a really neat quote that I came about, that I came across by Bodhidharma that I hadn't heard before. We don't usually think of him as being a really poetic figure, But this kind of shows us a different side. Here's what he said, one of his quotes. "The Buddha in the mind is like a fragrance in a tree. The Buddha comes from a mind free of suffering, just as fragrance comes from a tree free of decay." So that was a little taste of Bodhidharma, his poetic side. And his teachings were based on the recognition of two incompatible types of thought, rational and intuitive. Now, rationality, of course, as we know, employs language, logic, reason. Its precepts can be taught. But intuitive knowledge is different. It's embedded in our unconscious mind. And unlike rational thought, intuition can't be taught. In fact, it's impossible to even find or manipulate this intuitive consciousness using the rational mind, because rationality constrains our mind and intuition releases it. So that was the teachings of Bodhidharma. And he was atypical even of later Chan. Now, I should also mention that Zen in China is Chan, C-H-A-N. I will probably be saying Zen instead of Chan, just to make it less, you know, alien sounding. It's alien sounding enough with all these Chinese names and words. But so most of the time I'll just say Zen. But just so you know that, you know, then it was called Chan because it had not yet been taken to Japan. That comes later. I'm not going to go into that today. I'm going to stick with the earliest Zen teachers, which were in China. So Bodhidharma was atypical even of later Zen masters because, number one, he still promoted reliance on the sutras, but only one sutra. And that reliance was not in memorizing or the sutra as much as experiencing the teachings within the sutra. And that sutra was the Lakavatara. And it focused on the idea of emptiness and Buddha nature. The other way that he was atypical of the Zen teachers that the later Zen teachers will be talking about is that he spoke simply and clearly about the teachings. And if you've been around Zen for very long, you probably know it's not usually simple or clear. the paradoxical sayings of the teachers who came after him often stressed that studying the scriptures was a distraction, and they were often very obscure, as paradoxes tend to be. So that was the 6th century, and that was Bodhidharma planting the seed of Zen, planting the seed of Zen. So now the 7th century. 7th century was really important to the development of Zen because of two turning points, two things that happened, two major events. One, this was the beginning of Zen as a religion. And the second one was the emergence of Huayin Buddhism. So I'll talk just a few minutes about those two events. The beginning of Zen as a religion is credited to our fourth ancestor, Taoxian. And his teachings are not that well known, although he is recognized for further establishing meditation as a key component to Zen practice, and also mainly for forming the first self-supporting monastery, which combined Zen practice, Chan practice, with more popular Buddhist practices, thus broadening its appeal. So these more popular Buddhist practices included religious piety, for one, and rituals. And it helped to create a religion that took root in the broader population of China. since this time, since the 7th century, chanting of the Heart Sutra and following monastic rules has been widely accepted as parts of the religious practice in many East Asian temples. Hi, come on in. So this is important because of some of the events that took place in later, that we'll be talking about later. Zen may not have survived had it not penetrated a little more deeply into Chinese culture. So now I'm going to talk a few minutes about Wayan Buddhism, which came into being in the 7th century. It's based on the Avatamsaka Sutra, which describes a cosmos of infinite realms upon realms, mutually containing each other. And the vision in this work was the foundation of the creation of Wayan Buddhism, which is Chinese Buddhism. And it's been called the pinnacle of Buddhist philosophy, of Chinese philosophy or Chinese thought. It's all about the interpenetration of all things. And the teacher most associated with Wayan Buddhism is Fa Zen. And for the better part of his life, he worked in close proximity with the highest echelons of imperial power. So he was supported by emperors and empresses. And because of that, because of the popularity of this philosophy of interpenetration, along with the profound imagery that's contained within this sutra, helped to establish even deeper, the deepest roots of Chan in China. So just a kind of an aside story, there was an empress who was the ruler of China at that time, called Empress Wu. She could not grasp this interpenetrating reality, so she asked Fa Zeng to help her to understand. And what he did was he devised a hall of mirrors. And in the center, so this room that was all mirrors everywhere, and in the center of it was a Buddha. And so then he brought her into it, and she saw how everything reflected off of everything else. But Buddha was everywhere. Buddha was everywhere. And you can see a modern version of this, if you're interested, on YouTube, just by putting in Hall of Mirrors, or Empress Wu and the Hall of Mirrors. You can also learn a little bit about Empress Wu, the only, I think she even now is the only empress to ever rule China. And after her death, her enemies, which was kind of all the male rulers of the time, tried to kind of eliminate any word of her. They tried to get rid of all the successes that she had, to negate them. But if you go on YouTube again, you can see a documentary of Empress Wu, and it's pretty impressive how she ruled China. So that's the 7th century. And also another, our sixth ancestor, which is one of the most well-known ancestors in Zen, can't talk about the history of Zen without including Wei Nang, who also was a contemporary of Fa Zeng. And he is one of our most beloved underdogs, because when he arrived at the monastery where he would live for the next few years, he was a poor boy from the backward countryside who didn't even know how to read or write. Now, he personifies Bodhidharma's teaching that anybody can be enlightened. You don't have to be a literary giant, or you don't even have to know how to read or write. So whether or not this is really true that he was illiterate, he actually is responsible for writing the Platform Sutra, which is one of our foundational sutras later on in his life. So whether or not it was true that he was illiterate really doesn't matter. The fact is he personifies the earliest teachings of anybody can do this practice. So just a quick little story about Wei Ning is that because he was a poor boy from the countryside, backward countryside, he was assigned to laboring in the fields. And he wasn't even allowed to enter the meditation room with the real monks. But he proved his understanding at a poetry contest. So I'm just going to read the two poems that were in this contest, just to tell you a little bit about where the teachings were and the thoughts were at that time. So the head monk, who everybody assumed would win the contest, was the only one who had the courage to put up to even enter the contest, which was called, they were all called upon to demonstrate their deep understandings of the Dharma by writing a verse. So nobody had the courage to write the verse except for the head monk, who everyone just assumed would be the winner of the contest and then therefore become the sixth ancestor of Zen. That's what this contest was all about. So here is the here's the poem written by the head monk. The body is the awakening tree, the mind the mirror bright. Take care to keep it clean and let no dust alight. So that was the poem that everybody thought was going to win the prize. But when Wei Ning heard somebody reciting this poem, he immediately saw its limitations and saw through it to something, a deeper teaching. So he asked someone to write his verse on the wall. And his verse is this. The body is not the awakening tree, nor the mind a mirror bright. Since the first, no thing exists, where can dust alight? Now, dust, you might hear, if you hang around Zen, you'll hear that word a lot, dust, red dust, dust of the earth. That is the source of our delusion in the conventional world. So his, he is, in this poem, he is deepening and clarifying Bodhidharma's teaching on intuitive insight. That it's beyond mere logic and reasoning. He's also demonstrating his understanding of why in Buddhism and the interpenetration of all things. No separation between delusion and enlightenment. The interpenetrating nature of delusion and enlightenment is what he was demonstrating. So now, 8th century. Now, what happened in the 8th century was what's called the Onlushan Revolution. And what was going on at that time was that the country had gotten too big. China had gotten too big. It could no longer they could no longer protect their borders and grow enough food to feed everybody. So they were pulling the farmers away from their farm and forcing them to into the military to protect the borders, which was causing a famine. So what the emperor did was he brought in mercenaries to help protect the borders. He brought in a Turkish general by the name of Onlushan. And after General An Lushan did their bidding, he focused on his own bidding, which was to take over China. So he came in with an army of well-trained men, and the time that he was there, he was able to gather a lot of power, to amass a lot of power, and he declared himself emperor and set up a stronghold that almost brought down the Tang dynasty, which never really recovered from this rebellion. So just to give you quickly some idea of how devastating this was, two-thirds of the population of China died within a decade. Two-thirds, they died of either violence or famine within a decade, within this An Lushan revolution. One of their poets wrote, "The nation is destroyed, mountains and rivers remain. The nation is destroyed, mountains and rivers remain." But what does that have to do with Buddhist history, and why am I calling it a turning point? So the next Zen master I'm going to talk about is Zen Master Matsu. He lived through this devastation and famine, and he nurtured somewhere between 80 and 140 Dharma successors, depending on which version you're reading, which is the most ever in history. And he did this during this time of just, you know, so much tragedy. So how did he do it? How did he respond to what was happening? So when traumatized monks made their way to his monastery, how did he receive them? Did he receive them gently? They were traumatized, remember? They lost families, they lost friends, they were starving. Did he greet them with a warm embrace? You might think so, huh? Matsu devised what came to be known as the mind-disrupting techniques, like sudden blows, shouts, kicks, punches. And he popularized that as a teaching method. So why did he do that? Why did he meet the harshness of reality with even more harshness? So according to Janet Ables, the author of this book, it was like throwing cold water on the face of a traumatized person. And I want to read just a brief passage to you from this. And most of you, I think, particularly if you're familiar with Rinzai Zen, you're familiar with the punches and blows that the Rinzai, particularly Rinzai ancestors, were so well known for. Well, Matsu was the one who popularized that, and it happened during this time of the An Lushan revolution. So here's what this author wrote. "It was like throwing cold water onto them. Wake up," Matsu was saying. what did I say? Don't ask illusory questions, he was saying, with each blow or shout. Be with now. Be with this. This shout, this blow, because this is the only reality you have. Wake up from your thoughts of your village, your family, your home, your friends. These are dreams and they're no longer real. This kick is real. This shout is real. Be awake now. Be alive now. Experience the kick. Experience the shout. Let it shock you back into your life. So Zen is not about fleeing reality. It's about meeting reality. And sometimes reality feels like a sharp blow to the gut, doesn't it? So Matsu was all about developing urgency and immediacy in his students. So that's what I want to say about the methods of training in the 8th century. But what about the core teaching itself? Who is our champion? Who was deepening and clarifying Huayan Buddhism, which had now become the foundation of Zen? Huayan Buddhism, the interpenetration of all things. That is a easy thing to say, but how do you experience that right down into your bones and marrow? Because Zen is not about academic understanding. Zen is about transformation, which only comes from an experience. So now I want to talk about Shito, Zen Master Shito. In Japanese, his name is Sekito. And his life spanned almost the entire 8th century, from 700 to 790. And his response to what was happening was to write a very long teaching poem, which is called The Sandokai, or The Merging of Sameness and Difference. It was later adopted as one of the fundamental texts of Soto Zen. And here's just a sample of it, just to give you a little taste of the teachings in the Sandokai. It's referring to the absolute and the relative, meaning ultimate reality and conventional reality. And the poem says, the absolute and relative are like two arrows meeting in midair. Like two arrows meeting in midair. So how do we experience this meeting of two arrows? How do we experience this merging of sameness and difference? What does it feel like? Well, in the 8th century, it felt like whack, whack, blow, blow, shout, shout. It was harsh. So Tigan Layton, who is one of our well-renowned Zen teachers here, he lives in Chicago, he's written many books, he said that Shito and Matsu were the two great masters of their age from which all later Zen descends. So that was the 8th century. And now the 9th century. So about 100 years after the revolution, we have the Buddhist persecutions. At this time, by this time, Buddhism had really, really grown, really taken root. And so much so that the emperor began to feel threatened by the growing power of the Buddhism. It threatened his own power. In the major cities, Buddhist monasteries and temples had gained a lot of political and economic clout. So he felt threatened by that. So he ordered that all the monasteries and temples in the cities be destroyed, and that monks and nuns were forced to derobe and get jobs to support themselves. So basically his intention was to wipe out Buddhism. But what about the low-profile Zen monasteries that were mostly located far away from the power centers and by now were self-sustaining and not dependent on state support? And that began, again, with the fourth ancestor who built the first self-sustaining monastery. So these temples and monasteries, high in the mountains, these remote places, not only survived, but they thrived. So Zen actually thrived, both as we saw during the revolution, when we had more monks ordained by Matsu than any other teacher in history, more Dharma heirs actually, not just ordained. And now surviving the persecutions. I'm going to read real quickly from Jane Abels again. Zen not only survived, but thrived. It was affected the least, probably because its temples and monasteries were far away from urban centers, and its teachers were not politically inclined. However, there may have been other reasons. Perhaps it survived because its teachings focused on non-attachment, not attaching to the world of gain, of power, of identity, and of ego. And perhaps it survived because of the integrity of those Zen teachers in these far-off temples who insisted that this teaching be lived out. And for the most part, you know, Zen in America still tries to abide by those teachings. Non-attachment to power, identity, gain and loss, not politically motivated. So this is the 9th century, and our heroes of the 9th century, Tangshan, one I'm going to be talking about, for deepening and clarifying the central teaching, the teaching of Huayin Buddhism, interpenetration, and Baijing, for defining and refining the methods of training. So I'll start with Baijing. His way of monastic life defined the Zen way that we still follow today, and it consists of four parts. If you've been around the Zen Center for very long, or any other Zen Center, you'll be very familiar with these four aspects of Zen practice: meditation, Dharma talks, Dokusan, which is one-to-one meetings with a teacher, again from Bodhidharma, from the very beginning, Bodhidharma, who promoted the relationship between teacher and student, and work practice. So that's to have a serious Zen practice today, all four of these components must be included. Work practice, which we do here regularly, meditation, Dharma talks, and Dokusan. So you might be able to see where you're lacking if you really want to get serious about these teachings. Whatever you're lacking in any of those areas, that would be a good place to focus. So, Tangshan, our 9th century hero for deepening and clarifying the central teaching. He is also credited with the founding of Soto Zen. So, here we are. Here's where Soto Zen began to distinguish itself by way of both lineage and method of training. But it's not a clean cut. I mean, if you've been around many Soto Zen centers, you know that we also, our method of training also includes the koans, which is more basically a method of training with Rinzai. But the two schools, the two remaining schools of Zen, which is Soto and Rinzai, they've always been integrated because they share the same history, they share the same heroes, the same tragedies, and the same central teachings. Tung Shan, the father of Soto Zen, studied under both Shito of Soto lineage and also Matsu of Rinzai lineage. And also Bai Zhang, who I just talked about, who cultivated and refined the four basic aspects of Soto Zen training, was actually a Rinzai Zen teacher. So you see how interpenetrating our two schools are. So it's just on the focus of practice. So Tung Shan, he deepened and clarified the interpenetration, the interplay between form and emptiness with two of his most well-known teachings that he passed down. One was known as the Five Ranks. And that is, I'll just read them off quickly, then talk about them just about this much, because they're pretty advanced teachings. The five ranks are: one, form and emptiness; two, emptiness and form; three, coming from within emptiness; four is the arrival of mutual integration; and five is unity attained. So what these five ranks are actually doing is they're describing the workings of an enlightened mind. So they're starting, form and emptiness is starting at the moment of an awakening. And it's describing the deepening of an enlightened mind, which is not necessarily linear, but each of these layers, according to this teaching, the five ranks, each of these layers, which are also interpenetrating, and one contains them all, but they're not realized often all at the same time. And because that's a little bit, it's pretty deep, not easily understood. And you really will not understand it, you experience it. This is an experience of an awakened mind. The teaching that came after that was in an effort to try and clarify a little bit, to deepen it a little bit, was the Song of Jewel Mirror Awareness. The Song of Jewel Mirror Awareness. And this is a very long teaching poem, so I'll just give you just a little taste of this with two lines. The man of wood sings, the woman of stone gets up and dances. The man of wood sings, the woman of stone gets up and dances. So what does that mean? What does it have to do with anything? It's referring to the inner penetration of all things. It's a beautiful image of life arising from stillness. Life arising from stillness. Centuries later, in his Mountains and Rivers Sutra, the father of Japanese Soto Zen is a man named Dogen Zenji. And he wrote in one of his sutras, he wrote, "A stone woman bears a child at night. A stone woman bears a child at night." So again, he's referring to life arising from stillness. And night and darkness is often a metaphor for the time in which wisdom arises. The moon is a symbol of wisdom in Zen. So a stone woman bears a child at night. And if you think about it, you know, intuitive wisdom it always comes from the dark. We don't know where it comes from. But if we're, you know, if our mind is attaching to the light, meaning logic, rationality, things that we can see with our eyes, things that we experience through our senses, the five senses. Actually, in Buddhism, there's six senses because we include thought. When we're clinging to what we can experience through our senses, then intuitive knowledge is not allowed to come forth, to be a part of our experience. So the point being, again, Dogen, who is huge in our lineage, he was standing on the shoulders of not only Tangshan, but also the poet who expressed the cries of the world from the 7th century, who wrote, "The nation is destroyed. Only the mountains and rivers remain." Meaning the only source of nurturing that remained were the mountains and rivers. And Dogen wrote in his sutra about the mountains and rivers many centuries later that the mountains and rivers were the sutra. This was not a sutra about mountains and rivers. The mountains and rivers were the sutra. Mountains and rivers are the source of wisdom and nurturing. So, I could stop here because this was the history of Soto Zen. But then it would have been 400 years in China rather than 700 years in China. But three centuries after Tangshan and Baijing, three more centuries of directly experiencing the central teaching of Zen, the teaching of Yin, the interplay between the relative and the absolute, we get Hangzi. And with Hangzi, we get the Song of Silent Illumination. So I decided to include the 12th century and all the deepening and clarifying that happened between the 4th and the 12th century. Not the 4th century, the 9th and the 12th century. Because I wanted to talk about the Song of Silent Illumination. And in my opinion, it clarifies what meditation is, this interplay that we can actually experience better than any other of the teaching poems I've ever read. Tigan Leighton wrote that Hangzi's Song of Silent Illumination synthesizes the central teachings of our lineage. For me, it evokes a felt sense of this interplay that I've been talking about and the intimacy that's involved. So here are two lines. And this also is a very long teaching poem, and you can find it if you're interested in looking it up. But two lines of the Song of Silent Illumination. "In silence, words are forgotten. In utter clarity, things appear." So, in silence, words are forgotten. Silence means no words, no opinions, no ideas, no thought. The mind is still and spacious. So we begin to see each thought as it arises, instead of seeing it later after we've been carried off by it. Our head teacher here uses the image of a train. At high speeds, the cars blur past. But as it slows down, you see the gaps between them, just like you see the gaps between your thoughts. And the gaps are not created when the train slows down. And in the same way, the silence that we experience is not created as our thoughts slow down. We don't cultivate this silence. It's always here. Rather, we open into it. We open into it. So now, in utter clarity, things appear. So there are a lot of meditation practices where awareness is tuned down in favor of silence. But if we focus too narrowly in a rigid way on the breath or on repeating a mantra, we may feel calm, but we're not open. We've closed down around our object of meditation. But for the illumination aspect of silent illumination, we also have to remain open and receptive to the myriad movements of the mind and of the sensations and emotions that move through our body. So to get a sense of this wordless clarity, you might imagine a still lake. Pretty easy for us in Minnesota to do. When the surface of a lake is very still, it reflects perfectly all of its surroundings. It reflects the clouds overhead. It reflects the trees and the foliage along its banks. When a bird flies by, it reflects the bird perfectly. But when the bird crosses over the lake, no trace is left behind on the lake. Birds are often metaphors for thoughts. So our thoughts pass over our mind. We see them perfectly, but when they're gone, because we don't cling to them, no trace is left behind. We're not influenced by our thoughts. We just allow them to pass over. And our mind, like a still lake, reflects reality perfectly because we're not caught up in our desires and concepts and conditioned way of thinking and being in the world. So, in silence, words are forgotten. In utter clarity, things appear. So I'm going to end with one more taste of Hangzhe. And this is from an essay entitled Hangzhe, Dogen, and the Background of Shikantaza. Shikantaza is Zen meditation. This was written by Taigen Leiden. But this is Hangzhe, interpreted by Taigen Leiden. A person of the way fundamentally does not dwell anywhere. The white clouds are fascinated with the green mountain's foundation. The bright moon cherishes being carried along with the flowing water. The clouds part and the mountains appear. The moon sets and the water is cool. Each bit of autumn contains vast interpenetration without bounds. So again, harking back to the interpenetration of all things, Lyan Buddhism, 7th century. Each teacher standing on the shoulders of those who came before them. So Taigen wrote, like the flow of water and clouds, the mind can move smoothly to flow in harmony with its environment. So I think I will end there.